This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Even before this conflict started, West Darfur was the most food insecure, among the most food insecure states in Sudan. And so this conflict has exacerbated that situation.
That's the World Food Program spokesperson for Sudan, Lenny Kinsley, on food assistance to desperate people in West Darfur. Details coming up. Also, fears are mounting in Niger for Niger's detained president. And the week-long mini-bus taxi strike in Cape Town has ended. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Fears of Niger's detained president mounted today, a day after West African leaders declared they would muster a standby force in their efforts to return him to power. The European Union and African Union joined the United States in sounding the alarm for democratically elected President Mohamed Bazoum, who was ousted by members of his guard on July 26th. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said the detained president and his family have been deprived of food, electricity and medical care for several days. Bazoum says his 20-year-old son has a heart condition and is being denied medical treatment. A source close to Bazoum told the French news agency AFP that the coup leaders had brandished the threat of assaulting him in the event of military intervention. ECOWAS has approved the deployment of what it called a standby force to restore constitutional order in Niger. Reuters News says Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara has promised to supply a battalion of troops to the force, which is about 850 troops. Military governments in countries surrounding Niger, including Mali and Burkina Faso, continue to express support for the junta. Burkina Faso's government has suspended one of the country's most popular broadcaster, Radio Omega, after it aired an interview deemed insulting to Niger's new military leaders. West African leaders yesterday ordered the activation of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, standby force to restore constitutional order in Niger, following a military coup 2 weeks ago. But Michael Tanchum, a former senior fellow at the Africa Program of the European Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international relations at Navarra University in Spain, argued that while the West has provided military assistance to Niger, the focus should be on the country's food crisis. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi asked him why.
Because security is not just about physical security, which is extremely important, but it is also about having enough food to eat, enough clean water to drink and use for sanitation, having enough energy for your basic human needs. That's all security. And indeed, it's related to physical security. And so what people want to change in their lives, they want a better life. And they need to see an improvement in their life. If we look at Libya, people fought for a revolution, for democracy, and made great strides, but saw no improvement in their lives. Basic things, food, education for their children. So if we just focus on the military, we kind of set ourselves up for the next situation, because the whole solution cannot be a military solution.
But how serious is the food crisis in Niger?
It is extremely serious, and this is why I'm so astounded it has missed most of the media attention. One out of every five people in Niger is in a food crisis. 56% of people do not have access to drinking water. 44% of children are in severely acute malnutrition. 80% of the country is covered by the Sahara Desert. 14% of the land is arable. And Niger is heating up very quickly. That 14%, even that land is being degraded. The soil is being degraded by heat stress and drought. And when you think that 85% of the population in Niger is engaged in agriculture and directly depends on agriculture, this is a severe problem.
You relied on the history lessons from foreign interventions in sub-Saharan Africa to say that the narrow focus of military interventions to restore the security of the political order in Niger without achieving food security has proven short-sighted. What do you recommend to deal with the current crisis in Niger?
I'm glad you asked me that, because physical security is important. So, for example, the tri-border region between Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, 90% to 95% of the flow of grain has been cut off due to physical insecurity. And similarly, from Algeria, the flour, cooking oil, etc., has been disrupted 50 to 60%. That's both because of insecurity and the rise in fuel transportation costs. But Niger can feed itself more than it is now. It is really, it comes down to water. There is a saying in this part of the world, water is life. And there are very simple things that can be done that can make great improvements. And one of those would be drip irrigation. Drip irrigation, irregular irrigation, let me just very briefly explain. 50% of the water is lost. It never gets to the root in conventional flood irrigation. Drip irrigation saves 60% of the water and will improve the crop yield by 30 to 90%. And there was a pilot program in Niger with 900 farmers that did this, and they saw an increase in the crop yield of 82%. Now, that program only cost $1.5 million. Now, that might sound like a lot for us as individuals, but when you think of the millions of dollars that are put in as aid and military aid, the European Union just opened up a $30 million military base in Niger. This is where a little aid strategically applied can go a long, long way. But there doesn't seem to be the same kind of strategic thinking in terms of solving basic human needs in Niger as there is for physical security solutions.
That was Michael Tanchum, professor of international relations and political economy at the University of Navarra in Spain, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Former South African President Jacob Zuma was sent back to jail today to serve his incomplete contempt of court sentence, then released an hour later under a new program that took effect the same day. Zuma was first jailed in July 2021 for 15 months for ignoring a court order compelling him to appear before a commission of inquiry investigating corruption. He was released on medical parole after serving only 2 months of that sentence. Last month, he went to Russia for medical treatment. Then the Constitutional Court upheld the Supreme Court of Appeals' decision that his parole was unlawful, and so he should go back to prison. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Speaking during a media briefing today in Pretoria, Correctional Services Acting Commissioner Makoti Tobahale said Zuma arrived at the Escort Correctional Center in KwaZulu-Natal at 6 a.m. to comply with the order to return to prison.
He was admitted into the system. He was subjected to an administrative process, including the remission process that is already approved for all other offenders that qualify to be administratively processed under the remission process.
But the quick release has raised questions about how Zuma became the first beneficiary of this special remission program so quickly. Justice Minister Ronald Lamula argued that all was done above board, as Zuma benefited from a legal parole program approved by President Cyril Ramaphosa.
The president has exercised and taken his decision in terms of the constitution, in terms of the powers vested in him, that the president can remit a sentence of any offender at any time. It is not a specific decision about former President Zuma. It's about all the offenders across the country.
Democratic Alliance Party leader John Steenhuisen says the coincidence of starting this parole program on the day Zuma returned clearly shows that Ramaphosa's plan was to stop Zuma from going to jail.
And once again, the president's spineless nature to stand up for what is right, his inability to protect the people over party, has been on full display here. It has also set a fundamentally terrible precedent for South Africa.
But Minister of Police Bekicele told journalists that Zuma's release is welcome.
He has gone home now, like all other persons that has got this special remission. We say thank you, things are fine, we go on with life.
Ordinary South Africans are divided. Some say it shows there is no equality before the law. Others say his release is in the best interest of the country, as it has averted the kind of violence that erupted when he was jailed in July 2021, leaving 350 people dead. For VOA Africa, I am Thuso Khumalo in Johannesburg.
The week-long mini-bus taxi strike in Cape Town that left 5 people dead has ended. The South African National Taxi Association was protesting against city officials impounding taxis. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The strike started violently, with public transport buses and private vehicles being set on fire while some people were inside them. Fearful of being targeted, thousands of commuters stayed home from work, exacerbating financial pressures for many. Several day clinics closed due to staff shortages. In the last few days of the strike, some supermarket shelves were empty, prompting authorities to provide law enforcement escorts for food delivery vans. Throughout the strike, the Taxi Council denied its members were responsible for the violence. The region's Taxi Council leader, Mandla Hermanus, conveyed his condolences to the families of the deceased and said he hopes the perpetrators are brought to justice.
We apologize to the public for the distress and the inconvenience that the stairway has caused. And what we will do is to ensure that we go back to the task team to finalize some of the issues that we have not yet agreed on. But the fundamental issues, we seem to be finding each other.
One of the things the taxi task team will do is compile a list of minor offences which the Taxi Council feels should not be punished by impounding vehicles. Hermanus adds part of the agreement with the government is that the next 14 days will be used to work towards the release of taxis that were wrongfully impounded. Cape Town Mayor Jordan Hill Lewis, meanwhile, assured the public that their safety would not be compromised.
Impoundments under the National Land Transport Act will continue for vehicles driving without an operating license or on the incorrect route, or without a driver's license, or which are not roadworthy. Our focus will always be to ensure that all traffic offences which impact on commuter safety remain as major offences.
Hill Lewis says they also agreed a strike would never be called in the middle of a working day. At the start of the strike on August 3rd, taxi blockades on major routes caused hours-long delays for motorists returning home, and minibus taxi commuters were left stranded.
And that they will always give at least 36 hours notice ahead of planned strike action. We should never see a repeat of thousands of people being forced to walk home again.
A total of 155 people were arrested for various offences, including public violence. As yet, no arrests have been made for the 5 deaths, but authorities say all leads are being followed. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. UN agencies warn hunger in conflict-ridden Sudan has reached record levels, with more than 20.3 million people across the country, over 42% of the population, facing acute hunger. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
According to the latest UN food assessment in Sudan, the number of people projected to be food insecure between July and September has nearly doubled from the last analysis in May 2022. Deputy Food and Agriculture Representative to the Sudan, Adam Yao, says the situation is critical. Speaking from Port Sudan, of the more than 20 million acutely hungry people, he says 6.2 million are on the verge of famine. He says Khartoum, South and West Kordofan, and parts of Darfur are the hardest hit, with more than half their populations facing acute hunger.
Families are facing unimaginable suffering, and I've seen the impact of this conflict with my very eyes. I met with many of the affected community. They are destitute. They need help.
Because of the intensity of the fighting, delivering life-saving food aid to those in desperate need is extremely challenging and increasingly urgent. In what is seen as a breakthrough, the World Food Program was able to deliver food to conflict-ravaged West Darfur state for the first time last week. WFP's country director for Sudan, Eddie Rao, says his agency transported 125 tons of food, enough to feed more than 15,000 people for 1 month. Speaking from Port Sudan, he says women and children are particularly vulnerable as their husbands and fathers have been killed, injured, or gone missing.
These families are barely surviving. Most are only eating just one meal a day, sharing whatever food they have with their neighbors and selling whatever property they have simply to survive.
Rao says WFP hopes the route the five-truck convoy traveled from eastern Chad to West Darfur will become a regular humanitarian corridor. That, he says, would allow the agency to reach vulnerable families whose lives have been torn apart by the violence. WFP reports it has delivered emergency food and nutrition assistance to 1.6 million people across Sudan since the conflict erupted between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces on April 15th. Both WFP and FAO are urgently calling on the warring parties to facilitate humanitarian access to the millions of people struggling to survive as food becomes ever scarcer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
City authorities in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa have announced a crackdown on same-sex activity in hotels and bars and called on people to report such abominable acts to police. The Addis Ababa Peace and Security Administration Bureau said it was taking measures against hotels, restaurants, guest houses, and other entertainment venues suspected of allowing same-sex activities. The French news agency AFP says a statement posted on Facebook yesterday says the bureau already raided a guest house in Addis Ababa and arrested its manager.
On VOA Africa Radio, we let the sound tell you the story. News, sports, science, and entertainment available to you 24/7. Tune in on your local FM stations. We are also available on the medium waves, 909 kilohertz and 1530 kilohertz. Our short waves are 6080, 15580, 4930, 15165, 15580, and 17530 kilohertz. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news and information.
In the early 1960s, the Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie I, appointed Katama Yufru, a young Pan-Africanist, as the head of the foreign ministry, a decision that would have a massive impact on Ethiopian foreign policy. Katama Yufru is best known for his pivotal role in the creation of the Organization of African Unity, OAU, and was instrumental in finding solutions to various conflicts across the continent. His son, Mekonnen Katama, has chronicled his father's Africa-wide achievements in a new book titled Katama Yufru, A Champion of Peace, Progress, and Pan-Africanism. In the second part of our interview, the author talks about how his father convinced the Ethiopian government to help freedom fighters across Africa so the continent would be emancipated from colonialism.
Well, for him, it was not just talk. It was actually doing stuff. And what he did was, of course, he bought into the idea of unity. And he believed that anything can be accomplished if you're unified. If there's unity between all countries in Africa and the peoples of Africa. So it was through that spirit that he had the Ethiopian government help, you know, freedom fighters, so that the continent would be emancipated from colonialism.
Also, in addition to uniting Africa, in your book, you write that Ethiopia played a major role in solving conflicts in the continent during the 1960s and the 1970s. You write that your father assisted Emperor Haile Selassie in resolving the 1963 Algeria-Morocco conflict, Nigeria's civil war, the Congo conflict in Katanga,
yes,
and the Sudanese civil war. Briefly talk to us about those things.
You know, African solutions for African problems, that's what he was all about. So with Algeria and Morocco, he develops these good friendships with the foreign ministers. And it was easy because with Abdelaziz Bouteflika and the Moroccan foreign minister, you know, there was this one point where a plane, Ethiopian Airlines plane, landed in Morocco. And nobody expected it, but Abdelaziz Bouteflika, my father, came out of the plane. They were at war. So that was how much he was good at his job as far as, you know, conflict resolution. And the same thing in Nigeria. He had very good relations with President Gowon.
Yakubu Gowon?
Yeah, Yakubu Gowon. And they tried as much as they could to solve the conflict there too. And the same thing in Congo with the Katanga issue.
Finally, Mekonnen, let's talk about the role Ethiopia's foreign affairs minister under the Haile Selassie regime, your father, played in supporting freedom fighters,
yes,
including Kenneth Kaunda, Nelson Mandela, Jomo Kenyatta, Robert Mugabe, to name a few. Stories like Madiba, actually military training in Ethiopia. And then the former president of Zambia, Rufia Banda, in his student days attending Addis Ababa University after being granted a scholarship.
So there were several ways that they used to help. One was basically giving funds to the freedom fighters. The other, like you said, military training. We saw that with Nelson Mandela. And then there were scholarships given to several Africans to come and study at Addis Ababa University. There was a foreign minister who became, there was a Kenyan, later became a foreign minister as well. And this is how much Ethiopia was contributing to the cause back then.
Didn't Ethiopia, weren't they afraid of pushbacks by the colonial rulers?
There were
basically
so much pushbacks, but I think the emperor was steadfast. You know, he listened to his foreign minister and he decided that, you know, this is the way to go. And we're Africans, we're going to help our African brothers and sisters. And that's one thing about the emperor that he completely changed. And he was on this side, Africa this, Africa that. That was what he was doing in all his speeches. And as far as helping the continent as well, he was Africanized.
That was author Mekonnen Katama. He spoke to me from our studios here in the Voice of America. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer Mokbilia Baro and our engineer David Greenberg, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.